avoid or why until the very last moment. But his father knew right now.
"We need an hour," Hoffman said.
That was an eternity in special operations terms, but he wanted a big safety margin for problems. He hadn't done the recon personally. All the data he had came from Satil's teams in the field, scraps and crumbs pieced painstakingly together. He didn't even have a complete up-to-date floor plan, just an extrapolation from reconnaissance images and fragments culled from building contractors, cleaners, unwitting civvies who answered innocent questions without thinking where those innocuous pieces of the information puzzle might be assembled.
"And then we need to get out faster than we came in."
Hoffman said, "We." He meant we. He wasn't a kid anymore, but he stayed fit, and there was no way he was going to sit this out.
"I've got an idea," Michelson said, "but we've never tried it for real. General, I take it I can borrow a cargo Sea Raven and let my engineers loose with a welding torch, yes?"
"Budget no object." Ivor almost winced.
"And I've never said that in my career."
Phoenix gathered up his papers and gave a cursory nod to everyone. Satil stepped into his path and held out her hand.
"Those papers don't leave this building, sir," she said firmly. "But any time you need to come back in and read them, any time at all, just call my office. We're on permanent three-shift rotation."
Phoenix didn't look offended. He hadn't told his own son about this, after all, and Marcus Phoenix was going to be one of the men providing a cordon for the raid. That was the nature of this business. Hoffman found himself in an empty meeting room with Satil.
"I'll do it myself," he said. "I'll take the ASFO staff."
Satil looked as if she was about to put her hand on his shoulder.
"Shit. She thinks I'm sacrificing my goddamn soul for the patriotic cause."
But she hesitated and folded her arms tight across her chest.
"There's no moral case to answer, Major," she said. "If I fight, I fight to win. I don't actually believe it matters how you win in the end, because being sporting and fair is okay for thrashball, but it's an irresponsible way to run a war. Minimum loss of cog life. Everything else is secondary."
Hoffman shrugged. He had his own personal limits, but taking out enemy scientists was, he thought, well within them.
"Just make sure you give us enough information to identify them. Because I don't want to exfil and find we shot the janitor and left the head honcho intact."
"Ivor could deal with this with an airstrike once your men are clear."
"Agent Satil, people can survive pretty extreme bombardment, but they usually don't survive a cranial vault shot."
She looked embarrassed. Hoffman hated the thought that she was elevating him into some sort of hero. It had to be done, so he'd do it. He sure as hell wasn't going to ask a kid like Dom Santiago to do it, even if it was one of those things a commando had to do.
"You're an honorable man," Satil said at last.
"No," he said. "I'm a commander who never asks his men to do what he wouldn't do himself. No more, no less.
And maybe it's because the day I do, I won't have anything left worth living for." Hoffman walked out into the grounds of the house, surprised as always that it was still daylight after a meeting, and cut through the Tomb of the Unknowns. The mausoleum commemorated unidentified fallen gears, but there were also monuments to great battles, like Anvil Gate, as well as the graves of the most highly decorated war heroes, holders of the Embry Star. There was a kind of easy comradeship about it all. Generals and enlisted men lay side by side in death. Hoffman liked, needed, to look at the graves regularly, so that he didn't just understand calculated risks and acceptable losses, but also felt what he was doing at a level beyond language. He studied one elegant granite headstone. Sergeant Major Graham, J.
It wasn't that he was a decorated man that mattered. Graham was simply here, a stone's throw from the place where the decisions had been made that had ultimately put him in his grave.
Forget the medals. Am I prepared to swap places with you, Sergeant?
Yes, he was. The day he wasn't, he didn't have the right to lead men any longer. Maritime Operations Training Area, Undisclosed Location, COG Warship, CNV Pomeroy. Dom stood on the helicopter deck of Pomeroy and decided things were looking up after all. A sea raven settled onto its mark. It was a heavy lift variant, the naval version, but it was still the basic aircraft he wasn't just used to, but also positively loved. Every gear did. Ravens reassured you that the good guys had arrived and were either going to give you something you badly needed or get you out of somewhere you didn't want to be. There was nothing not to love about them. Their chucka-chucka engine note alone was enough to make hearts leap. Their rust streaks were sacred, and their pilots were all uniformly insane. This Raven looked a bit different. Its cargo doors had been widened. The rest of the squad, Young, Morgan, and Benjafield, and the two teams of Pisang Hillmen clustered around it as soon as the rotors stopped. Dom found himself looking down on the Pisanga's heads and wondering how any guy so small, and who didn't wear much armor beyond light body plates, could have such a reputation.
"So we're going to fast rope in, sir?" Timiu asked. "Change of plan?"
Hoffman shook his head. "No, you're still going to infiltrate in Marlins."
He gestured to the naval officer who climbed down from the Sea Raven's cockpit.
"Captain Michelson thinks he has a better solution for minimizing the time we need to spend on the surface without advertising our presence with ships."
"I suggested they'd need this capacity years ago," Michelson said.
He shook the gear's hands, something Dom wasn't used to from an officer.
"But now we can turn necessity into a virtue. The Marlin's range is something like 60 clicks at best, but you're carrying a lot of equipment, so that reduces it farther, and that'll mean a launch vessel standing off far too close to the Asfo coast. We could deploy you from a submarine, but it's too shallow. So the best solution is an airdrop."
Dom thought that meant lowering the small inflatable boats into the sea and then fast roping down into them. Okay, he was up for that. If it was rough and pitch black, it was going to be hairy, but they only had to get it right once. The Pisang troops watched in reverent silence. They were infantry, just like Dom and the others, and playing a seagoing role was alien to them as well. This was a new departure for the COG. Michelson had something to prove, then, that the Navy could do more than play ferry boat for big guns and big aircraft. His part, anyway. Dom had started to learn that politics, job politics, small p, was rife in the COG forces. That depressed him. It wasn't supposed to be that way. It was supposed to be a team effort. The oath he'd taken said so, that he was a part of the great machine of society like everyone else, joined in common cause. Great. We're a frigging experiment so some guy can build his department.
Okay, Hoffman said. I expect to get the go order any time. I don't know how long we've got to exercise this.
It's the pilots who need it, Michelson said. All you have to do is launch the Marlins. They'll get you where you need to go.
Plural, Hoffman muttered.
One Marlin per Raven, said Michelson. 12 men per boat. That's the best permutation, given what you've got to carry. Can I suggest that we just load ballast in place of the bots and ordnance for the dry run? If it goes wrong, then you've lost a lot of technical kit that isn't easily replaced.
Timiu made a noise that might have been a suppressed cough. It wasn't like they could replace commandos in a few hours, either.
I still don't get it, sir.
The ravens have been adapted as docks, Michelson said, smiling slightly as if he was repeating something for the heart of understanding. Like landing ships. You know, the bow doors aft. The raven slides the marlin straight into the sea.
Dom thought that was insanely low flying, even for a raven pilot. He'd be a meter above the water, maybe. Dom thought he got it. He really did. The drop wouldn't be any more dangerous or painful than riding heavy waves, but it was still risky. They manhandled one of the shallow-draft vessels up the Raven's rear ramp and into the cargo bay. The two Raven crew inside were wearing survival suits, the bright yellow kind for ditching over water.
"Get a move on, then," the crew chief said, gesturing at the marlin. "You sit back. We'll do the hard stuff. You know how to drive this tub, Gid?"
Malcolm Benjafield had volunteered to train as coxswain.
"My dad's got a powerboat."
"Oh, that's all right, then. You'll drown faster."
Marlins were designed to be easy to handle, if easy meant understanding that the sea wasn't a road and that it had a mind of its own. Dom had been trained in the basics, but this was Benjafield's baby now.
"Shit," he said, peering over Dom's head to the open ramp. "Are you going to do what I think you're going to do?"
"Oh, I don't know," said the crew chief, hooking up his safety tether. He was clearly a wind-up merchant, as the captain called it, a smartass. "Maybe we won't drown you this time. Got your flotation jacket secure? Good. Let's see how this bird takes to water."
The gears piled into the marlin and took up positions with crates and other heavy objects doubling as equipment. The six Pisang troops, who jumped in, seemed like they grinned a lot anyway, even when things were descending into total rat shit. Dom settled in behind Hoffman and decided it was going to be a great story to tell the kids when they were old enough to understand. It's going to be a hell of a story to tell Carlos and Marcus, too. Keeping this mission from his family tested Dom to the limit. Not even Maria knew anything beyond the fact that he was training for something that took him to sea. It bothered him, because part of the appeal of being a gear was to be able to share everything with Carlos and Marcus. But now he couldn't. And even if they fully understood why, it still made him feel uncomfortable.
"Okay. If we go down, the bay floods up before we can escape, remember?"
Benjafield said. Dom still found it disconcerting to have the driver sitting behind him, another thing that reminded him he would never make a sailor.
"Ditch procedure, got it?"
"Shit, Mal, do you have to?" Morgan said.
"Yeah,"
Hoffman growled.
"You're goddamn commandos. You'll take this in stride and bore your girlfriend senseless with endless tales of how hairy-assed you were."
If the old bastard was scared, he never showed it. Dom quite liked him.
Hoffman wouldn't have been half as reassuring if he'd been sweetness and light, or paternal, or even cheerful. The fact that he was bad-tempered and didn't give a damn who he offended was his thick layer of plating over a natural, honest fear like everyone else's, although Dom was sure his anxiety was more about coming up from the ranks than getting killed. The late-entry commissions like him had to prove everything to their fellow officers and nothing to their men.
"Wife," said Dom, "not girlfriend."
"Another kid due soon, yes?"
"Yes, sir."
"Let's get ASFO done and dusted so you can be there. And get yourself another frigging hobby or you'll have a whole thrashball team to feed before you're much older."
The ramp closed, and the Raven lifted vertically, turning toward the open sea. It was, minus the wet stuff, something they'd done plenty of times before. The view from the cargo bay was limited to snatches of forbidding, choppy gray seas through a couple of sidelights. Then the Raven slowed and hovered, whipping spray and leaving Dom staring through a blizzard of seawater. It was only when the crew chief clambered along the rails set on the bulkheads and the ramp lowered slowly that the sheer insanity of what the pilot was doing became clear. The tail of the Raven was level with the water. No. It was in the water. All Dom's common sense said that was a bad idea. C rushed in across the cargo deck. The noise reminded Dom that he had to start wearing plugs or he'd be deaf in a few years. But the sinus-rattling noise of the rotors couldn't take his mind off the fact that the Raven was in the damn sea.
"Holy shit," Hoffman said to himself. "Glad it's not just me, sir."
The crew chief gestured at Benjafield to start the engine. Dom wasn't sure if the Raven had lifted its nose to slide the Marlin clear, or if there was enough water on the deck to allow the hull to skid, but the two crewmen grabbed the boat's ropes and heaved it down the ramp. Dom couldn't see anything through the storm of spray. A wave slapped him in the face, and for a second he was sure they were going to be swamped, but Benjafield dropped the outboard, and they pulled away at low speed.
"Did you know they could do that?"
he yelled against the wind.
"I do now," Dom said.
Benjafield turned the Marlin in a big circle. They were looking back at the Sea Raven.
"Wow, that's insane."
Dom still didn't believe what he was seeing. The Raven was shrouded in whipping spray, apparently sitting in the water, ramp submerged. Then it lifted clear of the sea, draining water as if it had pissed its pants. Dom knew how it felt. Retrieval was a lot less exciting by comparison. The Raven winched them inboard one at a time, then hooked up the Marlin and lifted it as underslung cargo.
"That's not as hairy as it looks in the movies," Dom said to the crew chief. "Try it again in a storm when it's shipping it green."
There were days when Dom found it easier to understand the Pisangas, who didn't speak the language all that well, than the Navy. He assumed shipping it green was a bad thing.
"If you can drive the boat off the ramp like that, why can't you drive it back up?" Benjafield asked. "Isn't it a lot faster than winching?"
"You volunteering?" said the crew chief.
"Yeah.
Maybe we'll try that when we get a pilot who doesn't mind having a Marlin embedded in the back of his skull."
"You never tried?"
"Once. You'll need a lot more training before you try that stunt. Let's see how much time we have."
The gears stayed on board Pomeroy that night. Benjafield was awarded an unofficial Raven's pilot's brevet in the air crew's equally unofficial mess, beer was consumed in modest amounts, and everyone's confidence was sky high. They were commandos. They could do anything they set their minds to.
"I can only get better," Benjafield said sheepishly. "And Morgan's got to learn to do it yet."
Hoffman, nursing a glass of juice, dropped his guard as far as Dom had ever seen it fall, which wasn't saying much.
"It's taken 20 years to get a commando program together," he said. "Imagine what we could do if we moved away from the old infantry doctrine. More special forces, more cross-service teams, leaner, flexible, more agile response."
"Heresy, sir," Timiu said. "If you shrink the conventional army, you change coalition society. It works because the army is part of our social fabric. Citizens know what the price is."
"Damn! Who sent me a frigging intellectual?"
Hoffman actually laughed.
"Yeah, you're right."
Dom was happy. He was busting to call Carlos and tell him how they could dunk Ravens in the sea. He wanted to tell Maria. He'd get a call to her tonight. But all he could do was confine his excitement to the latest on the baby and try not to even hint at how he'd spent the day. There'd be plenty of time later to tell stories. He knew it. They were going to put Asfo Point out of business, and it was going to put an end to the Pendulum Wars.
Chapter 10. "You may think they're the government's troops, Chairman, but on the battlefield they are mine. They are my responsibility, my comrades, and my conscience."
Major Helena Stroud, 26th Royal Tyrone Infantry.
Fizeor Naval Base, North Corner Jetty, 0500 hours, 2 days before Operation Leveler, 16 BE. Carlos wondered if C Company would ever be allowed out in daylight again. It was a couple of dark hours before dawn, freezing cold, and the air stank of oil and burning paint. He stared up at the gray steel cliff looming above the dockside, craning his neck until the slab resolved into a warship with CNV Colonna picked out in peeling red paint on the bows. She wasn't exactly the pride of the fleet. She was small, grimy, and ugly. If it hadn't been for the cog ensign hanging limp from the jackstaff, he'd have taken her for a cargo vessel. Colonna looked as if she'd had her backside sawn off and half a ferry welded in its place, because she was an amphibious assault ship, a floating dock for landing craft with a helicopter deck covering a third of her length. She wasn't built to look classy. She was built to land troops and vehicles on beachheads. "At least it's got stairs," he said, nodding at the gangway. "I won't drown myself this time." The line of gears waiting to embark was almost silent. Some of them were asleep, sitting squatted on their backpacks with their heads resting in their hands or on folded arms, ready to be prodded to attention by a buddy if an officer passed or the line started moving. Gears got everything they needed in lavish quantities, kit, food, benefits, but not sleep. There was never enough sleep. They grabbed it when they could. Carlos debated whether to join them and get a short nap in. "It's called a brow," Marcus said at last, "not stairs." "Thank you, Admiral Phoenix. Did you get hold of Dom last night?" "He left a message, I left a message. Whatever he's doing, it's totally locked down now. Maria said she got a 30-second call from him." "Shit timing." "You said it." Carlos leaned forward a little to ease the weight of his pack. "Anything else?" "What?" "You're pissed off about something. I can hear it." "You called your old man, didn't you?" Marcus still had his back to him. All Carlos could see was the high curve of his backplate and the tight knot of the do-rag.
"Yeah."
"And?"
"I told him we were shipping out." He went really quiet. End of story, as usual.
Carlos didn't need to remind Marcus that his father couldn't bring himself to say that he was scared for him, or worried, or that he wished that he'd never joined the army. Whatever made Adam Phoenix clam up about Marcus's mother—guilt, pride, pain, some macho shit, who the hell cared—was stopping him from being honest yet again. And Marcus was no better at getting things out in the open than his dad was. What a fucked-up family. Carlos knew without asking that his folks would be waiting on the old gun battery at the entrance to Fizeor Harbor to wave farewell to Colonna. It was a low-key embarkation from a small logistics port, no media and no band, and gears wouldn't be lined up on deck to start people wondering what was going on. But the families knew. And they'd be there.
"You told him it was Colonna, right?"
Marcus paused for a moment, then turned around.
"No, I didn't."
Marcus looked puzzled rather than angry.
No, he looked hurt.
"And he didn't ask."
"You can always sort it out when you get back," Carlos said, trying to rescue the conversation from the pit. "You'll be a regular war hero, and he'll be all relieved you're alive. It'll be different."
"Yeah." Marcus turned back to face the ship again.
"Like it's been different on every other deployment."
A group of sailors leaned on the ship's rail, staring down at the gears waiting to embark.
"Hey, land crabs!" one of them yelled. "How did you swing the luxury cruise, you lazy overfed assholes?"
There were worse nicknames than land crabs, but cheerful inter-service abuse was reassuring. Chilly politeness, that would have been something to worry about.
Sailors thought the bulky gear armor was hilarious, and the wide-legged walk needed to cope with the thigh straps and boots just sealed the deal. They were crabs. The term was applied without mercy.
"What did it say, anyway?"
Marcus asked, impervious to taunts.
Dom's message.
"Just some crap about something amazing he did on exercise, but he can't tell us what it is. He's totally into this commando thing. I'm starting to feel like the kid brother now."
"Sounds happy to me."
"Yeah, Dom was happy. He had an instant life. Pretty wife, healthy kids. Carlos knew the baby on the way would be fine. And a job he loved. Everything tidy and stowed away early. He'd taken a situation that would have been a disaster for most kids his age and made it a triumph. That was typical of Dom. Carlos felt immensely proud of him, and just a little overshadowed. He hadn't bought Dom anything for his birthday yet. He'd have to sort that when they got back.
"She's coming," Marcus murmured, glancing over his shoulder. She took a deep breath. "Gears, tension!"
Marcus could hear Major Stroud a click away, but it wasn't hard. If it wasn't the boots, it was the voice. She strode past the gears, returned the salute, and then loped up the gangway to acknowledge the officer waiting at the top. It was only then that Carlos glanced sideways and saw who was following in her wake with a group of command and control cadets. Her daughter Anya again, this time in the Command Corps gray working rig.
She's like the handy travel-sized version of her mom. They must be running the op from the ship. Shit, that's rough, shoving cadets into frontline posts.
Marcus managed to look without moving his head. He went on looking as Anya teetered up the gangway in regulation high-heeled black pumps.
"Why do they make female support officers wear high heels? She'll break her neck."
The gear in front of Marcus, who hadn't looked as if he was taking any notice, let out a theatrical, lovelorn sigh.
"Then you can go give her some hands-on first aid, Phoenix, because we all know you're just dying to—"
Marcus's tone hardened a fraction, and he got even quieter.
"I see we've embarked the stand-up comedian."
The guy didn't say another word. The line of gears finally began moving, and the brow connecting Kelowna to the dockside vibrated under Carlos's boots. It seemed to take forever to get to the mess decks. Moving fully armored, laden gears through narrow passages and down steep open stairs, ladders, Marcus reminded him, took time. They were in 1E2 mess, because it said so on the bulkheads, stenciled in black. And that was all Carlos or Marcus knew right then. They still didn't know where Kelowna was going.
"I've been in bigger lavatories."
Carlos couldn't even turn around on the mess deck in armor. The bulkheads were lined with racks of bunks that looked like a challenge to squeeze into.
"Mind your back, Ty."
Calizo needed a deck to himself. He looked down his tattooed nose at a ship's rating who was trying to direct the gears to their allocated compartments.
"This ship must have been built for very short people."
"Don't mind him," Carlos said. He needed a favor. "He never makes sense. Is there anywhere we can see the harbor entrance when we sail?"
The sailor pointed down a passage full of gears, trying to stack armor without treading on one another.
"Up the ladder, and head aft. The hatch opens onto the flight deck, which you're right under, by the way. Don't go on the open deck. Listen for the pipe."
The ship's address system burbled in the background. The whole ship hummed and vibrated. There was nothing to do but wait, inhaling the new smells and trying to translate the foreign language being broadcast through the decks.
"Hands to harbor stations," said the disembodied voice. "Special sea duty men, close up."
"Does that mean we're moving?" Carlos asked.
Marcus grunted, staring at the deckhead from the top bunk like he was trying out a coffin for size. How he'd managed to squeeze into the space was beyond Carlos.
"More or less,"
Come on, I gotta see if my folks made it. It was just about light enough to see detail when they opened the door under the deck and looked out. There was no ceremonial, no sailors lined up looking smart, just guys in blue overalls clearing ropes and cables.
"Is it a door or a hatch?" Carlos asked.
"Door," Marcus said. "Hatches are in decks, usually."
"You need to get out more."
"Just look, will you?"
Carlos scanned the docksides and jetties, and then focused on the ancient harbor walls. He could see a small group of about a dozen people huddled against the cold.
"Shit, why didn't I bring some field glasses?"
He strained to see.
"Will they even see me?"
"There's your mom," Marcus said. "Look."
He was right. Carlos was elated. His mother, his father, and Maria. Damn, what was a woman about to give birth doing out in this weather? Were there with the others. Carlos didn't care about pissing off the sailors. He stepped out to the rail and waved frantically.
Yes, they saw him. They saw him. They waved back.
"Shit," said Marcus.
Carlos thought it was just his all-purpose reaction to anything entering the dangerous territory of emotional stuff. But then he saw what Marcus saw. Adam Phoenix was standing to the left of the Santiagos, not with them, just near them. And he raised one hand in a slow, sad gesture of farewell. Carlos didn't look at Marcus. He needed to drink in every second of his own family. He didn't have time to see if Marcus acknowledged his father. He just heard the rasp of fabric behind him and a faint breath.
So he waved back.
"It's a start, Marcus."
Carlos watched and waved until the ship passed the cardinal buoys marking a sandpit, until he couldn't see the people ashore as individual shapes any longer. When he turned around, Marcus was staring back at the land, too.
"It's friggin' cold," Marcus said, all denial.
His eyes always made him look brutally unfeeling, even when every other gesture told Carlos he wasn't.
"Let's get below."
"You said you didn't tell your dad where or when, but he found you."
Carlos had hope of getting the two of them to behave like regular humans one day and realize they were family. Life was too short for all this shit.
"He tries, Marcus."
Marcus vanished into the ship ahead of him.
"Yeah," he said. "He found me. Ain't it interesting how he managed to do that?"
Hangar deck, Kelowna, 2 hours later. So now, at least, Bernie Mataki knew where she was going. C Company sat or squatted in rows in front of a big screen on the hangar bulkhead, as if they were waiting for the ship's entertainment to begin. The CIC team and landing craft coxswain stood to one side as Major Stroud pressed the button.
"This is the output from a couple of UIR news channels," she said. "We have their attention."
All the doors and hatches were dogged shut and guarded. Bernie couldn't work out why there was so much security on their own ship, when the whole thing was on the news already. Shaky aerial footage showed COG warships steaming through waters to the north of Ostrini, and was interspersed with scenes of UIR troops mobilizing on the Pels border. Austrian and Pelsian politicians were pissed off. Bernie didn't need to understand their language or read the subtitling to get the drift. Major Stroud stepped in front of the screen and switched off the sound.
"That's all complete bullshit," she said in her plummy tones. "You've probably realized that we wouldn't be going ahead with a beach landing if they're already running trailers for it on TV. So while they're busy waving their dicks at us to the north, we're heading south to support an assault on Asfo Point by our commando detachment, which will be a small-scale action conducted in minimum time. Your task is to insert to the north of Asfo Point to cut off any attempt to defend the facility and give the commandos time to do whatever it is they do when nobody's looking.
They bang out, you bang out, and everyone's back on board before the UIR even realizes it's been had over backward. Welcome to Operation Leveler. Now, gather around and look at the maps.
Stroud was to the point, if nothing else. Bernie decided it couldn't hurt to ask.
Ma'am, what's the significance of Aspho Point?
Weapons research, Stroud said. If I had to explain any more, I'd have to get a decent physics education. Let's leave it at asset denial.
Marcus was sitting to Bernie's right, next to Carlos. She heard him let out a breath. Carlos rolled his head as if he was going to shake it, then muttered to himself, "So that's what he wouldn't tell us."
"Tell us what?"
she whispered. "Dom," Carlos said. "That has to be what he's been training for." The screen now filled with aerial recon images, and Stroud pointed out streams and bridges. The map said Aspho Fields, but it didn't look like rolling pasture at all. It looked like marsh, flat as a pancake and with only pockets of cover. Still, the Major said fast, and that meant there'd be no spending days in a water-filled hole just waiting.
"Current as of 26 hours ago," Stroud said. "If they spot us and respond, they'll have to come down those routes if they're committing land forces. Latest satellite data shows they've moved a brigade about 50 clicks northeast and reinforced the gun battery near Berifus since the flotilla took up position, but that's the most immediate threat so far. The two bases near Aspho are still only company strength at best, but there's always the risk of an airstrike. It's going to be all about speed. Get in, do the job, and get out. Preferably 1 hour. Definitely within 2.
Anya Stroud edged into the briefing.
"Met forecast is for high winds and heavy seas, so timing is going to be critical."
Marcus was staring at the aerial view of Aspho Point with a deepening frown.
"Ma'am, if we're not detected on the approach, when do they first work out that Aspho Point's under attack? Any time between the first guard getting a round through his head and the charges going off. They could have a few fire teams there in minutes, a helicopter in 20. So why not just pound the target from the sea and send in a few ravens to finish up?"
Stroud began marking up a paper map spread on a small trestle table, head down.
"Because we want to keep some souvenirs intact."
"Sounds like the kind of souvenir my father collects."
He said it almost casually, but the way Carlos glanced at him confirmed to Bernie that there was a lot more to it than that. She wasn't his platoon sergeant now. Maybe she'd have a quiet word with Daniel Kennan, who was, just to make sure there was nothing that was going to distract Marcus over the next couple of days. She'd known Marcus for 2 years, in the family-close way of platoon relationships, and she still knew even less about his real family than she did about Hoffman's. Marcus just kept it all locked away. They had just hours now, not days, to refine the plan. Stroud was putting her faith in the Stomper, the belt-fed grenade gun mounted on each platoon vehicle. She also put her back into it, doing the heavy work alongside her gears to ready the landing craft and the weapons. It was powerfully motivating. Bernie, who had never really wanted to be a gear until a recruiting sergeant told her that women made crap soldiers anyway, and especially crap snipers, found herself anxious to do a good job for Stroud. Motivation. There were a million ways to do it. You just had to judge which lever would move the individual.
"Crafty bastard," she muttered,
realizing the lever the recruiting sergeant had pressed in her all those years ago. Carlos paused with an ammo crate, sweating. It was a good way to keep warm in this freezing tub.
"What, old man Phoenix?"
"Now, some dead bloke. What do you mean?"
Marcus's dad came to see him off, even though Marcus hadn't told him the where and why. Carlos lowered the box and ran his hand over his forehead, before wiping his palm on his pants.
"He's part of the op. Didn't tell Marcus, though."
"Isn't Marcus used to that security shit? Phoenix is all classified and eat before reading.
Well, there's a lot his dad hasn't told him over the years. Personal stuff. Just rubs him raw, I think.
Bernie took the cue to back off for the while. But she knew enough now. Marcus, for all his apparent maturity and iron discipline, was still a normal lad who could be hurt by his dad. It was the kind of stuff a sergeant needed to know.
"Yeah, crafty bastard," she said.
Air Crew Headquarters, CNV Pomeroy, at anchor 200 kilometers north of Asfo Point.
"Sir, if I get killed, what will you tell my family?"
Hoffman stopped pressing his jacket and looked up at the kid standing in the open doorway. Ludovic Young didn't look particularly anxious. Lads could think about the possibility without imagining it would actually happen to them. Young was just a methodical character who liked to have everything in order.
"I'll tell them the truth," Hoffman said.
He always avoided trotting out the reflex reassurance that nobody was going to die. He'd only ever said that once, and he'd been agonizingly wrong.
"As far as the secrecy of the mission allows me, and if we pull it off, it won't be very secret."
"Thank you, sir. I wouldn't want them to get a shock years later."
Hoffman decided his uniform could live with a few creases. It was time probably better spent on getting the team together for a morale session. He wasn't good at that kind of thing. He didn't know how to lead. All he could ever do was stand up and tell those under him what he thought of them, what he wanted them to achieve, and then become one of them while they did it. It seemed to work.
"Young, assemble everyone on the hangar deck," he said. "I'll be along in a few minutes."
Hoffman wasn't good at waiting, either. He went to the ops room to find Michelson and check on the progress of the decoy fleet and the landing ship. The place was quiet and dimly lit. Ratings sat at their screens, intent on whatever data or plot was in front of them. It took Hoffman some time to work out which section was dealing with charts. It all looked the same to him.
"So where's Kelowna now?" Hoffman asked.
Pomeroy's first officer, Fuller, pointed him at a screen and tapped anonymous-looking dots with numbers superimposed on them. A cluster was forming a few kilometers north of them, looking for all the world as if it was gathering for an assault on the coastal cities of Bonborg and Berefus, and the canal that cut through Austria's northern territory to Pels beyond.
"Well, I'm convinced by that, Commander," Hoffman said. "Any idea if the Indies are buying it? I've not heard a damn thing from Ivor yet."
"There's a satellite pass in 45 minutes. We'll have updated aerial images then."
There was no substitute for a full recon on the ground done by Gears. The best they'd been able to do was get intelligence via Satil's team, and Hoffman still didn't know a thing about them. He had to trust her network. They'd come up with the layout of Asfo Point, and a hell of a lot of technical information, after all. "But in the future, after we prove what we can do, I'll make damn sure we have Special Forces recon teams. No third-party intel. Gears finding out what Gears need to know."
It wasn't just the end of the war that rested on the success of Operation Leveler. It was a new military doctrine, a different army from the one Hoffman had grown up in. He believed in the power of small, specialist teams. The ops room team sat up a little straighter, eyes still fixed on their screens. Michelson had walked in.
"Kelowna's underway," he said. "She should be on station by 2300 hours tomorrow, and her LCTs will be away by 2530. "Okay. I better tell my boys now. One of them has a brother and best buddy in C Company. I haven't enjoyed sitting on that fact."
"Might improve morale a hell of a lot."
"Their morale is pretty damn good, actually."
"By the way, my admiral's been asking Dalyell what his final orders are if your team gets taken out.
Michelson said quietly. Hoffman not only expected the question, but knew the answer. There was only one possibility.
And Dalyell told him to throw in every missile and air asset he had and sink the whole area, right?
Michelson nodded.
Just thought you ought to know. I'd be disappointed if he hadn't, Hoffman said. Once they know for sure what we're after, there's no going back later. Gotta cream the place.
Of course, it all depends on what Dalyell defines as getting taken out. In other words, what he regards as a failed mission. Maybe that was the real message from Michelson, something he'd overheard, intercepted, or deduced that made him think they all had a nervous boss with a shaky finger on the button.
I thought it was Ivor's operation.
Maybe Ivor still does, Michelson said. So much for it not being enough to simply deny Hammer to the UIR.
Then we'd better leave no margin for misinterpretation of our success.
Hoffman had learned all the doublespeak of command, but it wasn't his mother tongue.
I told them to do this from the start. It's always sobering to bite yourself in your own ass.
By the time Hoffman got down to the hangar deck, the commandos were stripping down their lancers, and the Pisang troops were sitting patiently cross-legged on the deck like a class of well-behaved children.
As you were, Hoffman said. It's just the waiting now. Kelowna's on her way, and tomorrow night she's going to land an infantry company. They'll have your backs at Asfo Fields if the Indies counterattack. If it goes to plan, you'll all be in and out before the bastards know what's happening.
He looked at Dom, whose expression was unreadable for once.
Sorry I didn't warn you earlier, Santiago. It's C Company.
Dom seemed to chew over the news and then smiled. Have they been told who they're providing support for?
I don't know, Hoffman said. I'll check.
Well, I got away with that one. Hoffman didn't like being kept in the dark, and he assumed it offended others equally. Sometimes it didn't. He couldn't imagine why. He turned to the Pisang troops.
Anything more you need, Sergeant?
Bai Tak smiled broadly and indicated the huge leather sheath hanging from his belt. It was so long that its tip extended past his hip and rested on the floor.
We got everything we need, Hoffman, sir.
The Pisangas were small men with permanent grins and almond-shaped eyes, unfailingly cheerful people from some remote part of the cog that Hoffman had never visited. Usually they herded cattle on mountain slopes, but it must have been a pretty rough kind of farming, because they carried the biggest knives Hoffman had ever seen. The blades weren't ceremonial. Pisangas were shock troopers. Their task was killing, fast and silently. They'd certainly proven their worth at the siege of Anvil Gate.
Okay, Hoffman said. I'll be in my cabin. Get some sleep.
The men probably would, but Hoffman knew he wouldn't. He spent the rest of the evening composing his usual letter, as he did before every engagement, when he had the time to plan this far ahead, and wrote Margaret Hoffman in capitals on the envelope. He'd hand it to Michelson for delivery if the worst happened. He'd done it so many times that the words no longer had the same weight that they had when he first realized that this would be the most important thing he ever wrote. Words that would have meaning beyond their weight or intention, because they'd be his last to her. Sometimes he wanted to let her read one, just to see her reaction. But every time he retrieved it from whoever had been tasked to hand it over, he burned it. The sentiments had varied a lot over the years. The one he wrote at Anvil Gate had been heartfelt. Those that followed were simply designed not to make things any worse. She'd probably donate it to the RTI Museum one day. Mindful of that, Hoffman made sure that his last words would reflect well on the regiment. Chapter 11 Santiago is an exemplary soldier and one of the most courageous men I've ever met. But even with his outstanding record, I can't recommend his promotion to corporal. His loyalty to Phoenix may well exceed his loyalty to the COG. Even if it doesn't, then his decision to testify for Phoenix must call his judgment into question. However, even if I have to refuse his promotion, I'll state privately that this is a man I can only admire for his refusal to abandon a friend, knowing what it would cost him. Lieutenant Colonel James Amston, assessing Private Dominic Santiago shortly after Marcus Phoenix's court-martial. North Gate Food Facility, Jacinto. Present day, 14 years after E-Day.
Wow!
Frederick Rojas was waiting to meet the inbound Raven. He looked almost cheated when Bernie jumped out with a ripening black eye and a split lip.
Who did that?
Grub, Dom said. Without his helmet, Frederick looked horribly young and way too much like his dead brother Jan for comfort. She invited him to sit down and discuss their differences.
You slugged it out with him? I mean, really? Fists?
Much as I'd love that rumor to spread, Bernie said, the thing hit me while I was carving him.
Wow, I missed a lot.
Bernie patted him on the head as she passed.
Long may that continue, sweetheart.
Hoffman almost fell out of the Raven and stalked across the compound with obvious difficulty. Lieutenant Barber raised an eloquent finger behind Hoffman's back from the gloom of the door.
You really should get that looked at, sir, Barber called after him. That dressing won't hold forever. You sure you won't come back with us?
I'll live, Hoffman grunted. Thanks. Now get back to base. That's a valuable air asset you've got there.
Marcus didn't rush to help him. Cole did. He shoved a hand under the colonel's arm, and there was nothing Hoffman could do to stop him. He seemed embarrassed about getting shot. Cole sat him down on the running board of an APC and took a painkiller hypo out of his belt. He rustled the sterile packaging.
You want me to do this, sir, or you want to do it yourself?
I'm not in that much pain. You hang on to it, Cole.
Hoffman unfastened his boot, rolled up his pants leg, and examined the dressing.
You'll probably need to stick it in your own ass to put up with Baird on the way back.
He's ugly, sir, but he's useful.
Where's Jack? It should be back by now.
Marcus stood with his hand to his ear, listening to the radio chatter.
Lieutenant Stroud's directing it. She's checking the route back.
He paused.
A lot of stranded about. 2 more locust reports. Nothing close enough to the route to worry about yet. Is that your yet?
No, Colonel, it's Stroud's. She's always cautious.
Dom checked his watch and then looked up at the sky. It was overcast. They'd lose the light even sooner. Night movements were something any sane gear liked to avoid, as much because of the nocturnal predatory krill as the locust. Even though no krill had been seen since the light mass bombing, the compound was flooded by arc lights as the frantic loading continued. That would be enough to keep krill at bay. A crowded compound like this would be an ideal hunting ground for them. All that flesh cooped up with nowhere to run from their razor wings. He couldn't hear any chickens. He wondered idly if the birds warned each other not to go out in case the predatory humans got them and wrung their necks. Sergeant Perry walked briskly along a line of vehicles and then headed in their direction, making a gesture at his wrist. He broke into a jog.
"How long, Staff?"
Hoffman asked.
"Inside half an hour, sir. We're going to start moving the front section into position now." "That was fast." "We haven't cleared everything, just the priority list and every single spare part we could pry loose. No telling if we'll ever be able to come back and retrieve anything later."
"Good work, Perry."
Hoffman eased himself up with a white-knuckled grip on the armadillo's door.
"Phoenix, get your vehicle in position."
Dom swung into the driver's seat. Marcus slid in and sighed. He'd settled back seamlessly into being a gear, as if he'd never been away, but it wasn't seamless for Dom. He wanted to know what had happened to him in those 4 years in prison. In the short time since the escape, there just hadn't been the right moment to even begin to ask him if he'd received any letters or how bad it had been in there. And Dom was conscious of being a whiny kid again, pestering Bernie about Carlos, and now maybe risking cracking Marcus's apparent equilibrium. Nobody could spend 4 years in the slab and come out as if nothing had happened. That was the worst thing about the lulls in the fighting. They were best filled by eating, sleeping, or arguing, because thinking just let the dead and lost wander back in and make you wonder why you were bothering to carry on. Why? Because she's out there somewhere. Because Carlos would never have quit. Because Marcus needs hope, too, and Cole, and Baird, and Ty. "I think Bernie's pissed off with me," Dom said as they waited for Rojas. "She's never pissed off with anyone, except Baird. I've asked her twice about Carlos." Dom didn't have to explain what that meant. Marcus never wanted to discuss it. "She said she'd tell me what happened."
"Yeah, I heard."
Marcus stared ahead for a moment, then turned to face him.
"You think that's going to do either of you any good?
In all these years, you've never said much about it, and it never got to me until recently. You know how when people think they're running out of time, they suddenly want to see people they haven't seen in years and get their lives in order?"
"Yeah, but you're not running out of time."
She was honest. She said it would upset me. Marcus turned back to face front.
"He got blown up, Dom. For fuck's sake, you want to hear that frame by frame? He got the Embry Star. If the Locust hadn't shown up, they'd have made a movie about him by now. If..."
The top hatch vibrated as Rojas jumped into the rear seat, all bright enthusiasm. It killed the conversation stone dead. Dom wanted to yell at him in frustration, because this was the longest conversation he and Marcus had had about Carlos's death in years.
"Hey, sorry."
Rojas leaned forward between the seats and looked from one man to the other. Now that he had his helmet on, he looked and sounded exactly like Jan, and Dom found it almost unbearably upsetting. The dead wouldn't leave him alone today.
"I was just helping Ty move the dill. Some civvy blocked him in with a flatbed, and I was worried he was going to eat the guy alive."
Marcus changed back into the public Sergeant Phoenix again.
"Ty's usually mellow. Says some weird shit, but he saves the aggro for grubs."
The discussion was as far away as it had ever been. Dom waited for the order to move out, head resting against the side hatch, while he tried to imagine what could possibly be worse than the death he had imagined for Carlos so many times over the last 16 years.
"Control to Delta."
Anya Stroud's voice made him start.
"Delta, there's some new Locust movement I'm monitoring. Jack's doing a sweep in stealth mode. Just stay sharp when you move out, okay?"
"Yes, ma'am," Dom said automatically.
"Rumor has it the canteen is serving noodles tonight. I just wanted to motivate you. Think meatballs."
"No Locust can stand between a gear and his meatballs."
"That's the spirit. Control out."
Rojas leaned forward again.
"I didn't know she had a sense of humor."
"We go back a long way."
"Oh."
"There's no oh, okay?" Dom didn't have a sense of humor where women were concerned. There was only Maria. There would always only ever be Maria. It was 10 minutes before Dom's earpiece activated again, and this time it was Hoffman.
"Move out, Santiago. Convoy drivers maintain intervals. No stopping. Be ready for redirection in the event of a breakdown or enemy contact. Use your call signs on the radio, keep your channel open for instructions, and only transmit if absolutely necessary. Hoffman out.
Dom